Hello and welcome into this edition of the Golf Show Podcast with Rex and Lav. Well, folks, it is almost U.S. Open week, but first, we did have some business to attend to at the RBC Canadian Open, and for the first time in 239 starts on the PGA Tour, the fifth longest active streak on tour, Bud Cauley is finally a winner on the big tour. Had a hot stretch of four birdies on the back nine to race in front and win in Toronto. Rex, you were out there covering the golf tournament. You have since relocated to the airport Marriott, no doubt. What was it like for you to see Bud Cauley finally break through on the PGA Tour after about a decade and a half?
I mean, that was one of those special stories because we've sat and watched Bud Cauley sort of toil, go through all of these injuries, the horrific injuries that he suffered in that car crash in 2018 at the Memorial. Everything. He was the GWA Ben Hogan Award winner this year for all of the reasons that we just pointed out. Like I asked him tonight, did you ever get to a point that you didn't think this was going to happen? And he sort of flummoxed. He was like, I didn't think I was ever going to play golf again at one point. Like the things that went on in my life over the span of, you know, trying to rebuild my body, trying to rebuild my game, trying to rebuild my confidence, all those things were in tatters. So the idea that he finally got here is very rewarding. I will say, and I think Justin Thomas tweeted this earlier tonight, that he was probably one of the most underrated PGA Tour pros because he hadn't won. But I would also make the argument that he'd probably run up against a couple of guys given the opportunities that he could have won. He probably got really unlucky a couple of times on a Sunday afternoon. And then, of course, he got set back by those horrific injuries. And I was having this conversation on Saturday night with a player. If you're on that list, if you're among the top five of that list that you have that many tour starts without a win, yes, that's a bit of a knock. That's a list you don't want to be on. That's the best player who hasn't XYZ, whatever you want to fill in the blanks. But you've also sustained a career without having won. And I think that in itself shows, one, determination, two, talent, three, consistency, all those things that we value as golfers. I love the story. I love the idea that the emotions were there. In the interview I had with him this afternoon when he finished up, the idea was that once he chipped in on the 12th hole, and that's when he sort of started separating himself from the field and he ended up going on a tear. It's funny how even in a golfer's mind, he admitted that, yes, like once you do something like that, it felt like it was my day. It finally felt like I was going to be on the right end of this.
Yeah, I want to get into what happened on the back nine because it certainly was a pretty quick switch where it looked like, I don't know, maybe a half dozen players at one point looked like they could seriously win the golf tournament, including Jackson Suber, who had an opportunity to win just a couple weeks ago at the Nelson as well before Bud Cauley went on that hot streak. You mentioned that list, Rex, of active players, the longest streak that currently resides, the title holder right now is Patrick Rogers with 330 starts without a win. Mark Hubbard is next on the list with 277. Bo Hostler with 245. And your boy, Sam Ryder at 240, who again was just edging out Bud Cauley, who prior to this week was at 238 starts without a PGA Tour victory. I find that list pretty surprising for a couple of reasons. First of all, Patrick Rogers at 330, Bo Hostler at 245. Patrick Rogers was one of the first junior players that I ever covered in golf. He was a phenomenal junior player. Heading into college, I put a list of the top 10 class of high school class of 2011 standouts. That would have been Justin Thomas. That would have been Jordan Spieth. Xander Schauffele was on that list. Daniel Berger was on that list. I had Patrick Rogers as the number one player coming out of junior golf. And keep in mind, he had a brilliant amateur and college career as well, where Patrick Rogers won 11 times at Stanford, tying Tiger Woods' record. Obviously, Tiger did in 2 years. But still, like, this was a player who, by all accounts, was going to be a very successful PGA Tour pro. And if you took the 15 to 20 minutes that the PGA Tour just put out about sort of a Patrick Rogers feature they had on the social media and YouTube channels, like, it went into the deep dive of here I am trying to better myself, trying to better my career, trying to improve as a player and a person while still dealing with sort of this outsized goal that I have of winning ultimately on the PGA Tour. And how do you find fulfillment if the thing that you've been greatest at throughout your entire life, winning golf tournaments, playing elite golf, has not necessarily translated to winning on the PGA Tour? So I think that's a pretty interesting parallel with what happened with Bud Cauley as well. Look, Bud was a great junior player, phenomenal amateur player, but his skill set, Rex, I don't think has necessarily been dominant. He's never going to be the best driver of the golf ball. He's never going to be the best iron player. His short game and his putter. His putter certainly let him down in the first half of 2026, but it was his putter and I think some pretty good breaks as well that he was able to capitalize on on the back nine is what led him to this victory.
I mean, chipping in on 12 from that lie.
It was
essentially just
a long rough.
Yeah, he ended up stopping right there on the edge. He said as much. Like, look, he got some breaks. And that's why you start to feel like it's your day. And you're absolutely right. You have a player that is that decorated coming out of college. And this is a good conversation to have right now, because go back to where we were on Saturday night. Ben James, who is making his first start as a professional this week at the in a PGA Tour event. I mean, here is a PGA Tour U kid that just, 2 weeks ago, he was playing for the University of Virginia in NCAAs. He was leading a PGA Tour event through 54 holes. We have this conversation all the time, and you being the college expert, you know this better than anyone else in the game. You understand that they are better now than they ever have been coming out of college. You understand that they are just game ready, that there is no more learning curve. And it was funny. I was at breakfast this morning with Jim Gallagher Jr., who covers a lot of college golf and BR and some of the guys on the telecast. And they were saying that was never the case back in the day, that they are absolutely 100% ready to win on the PGA Tour. And yet you end up with a Patrick Rogers, or in this particular case, Bud Cauley. It's a little bit different because of the injuries and everything he has gone through in his career. But it is pretty shocking when you consider the level of talent. And we have this conversation all the time. You and I both huge fans of PGA Tour U, but largely they're hits. But there are a couple of misses, and I'll go back to Gordon Sargent. Like, here's a player that everyone thought was going to be that next big player, and maybe he still will be. Maybe he just needs that time. Maybe he's one of those guys that needs the learning curve. But by and large, most of them come out and they're ready to swing, and it's more surprising now than ever when you end up with a Patrick Rogers, because you would have thought he would have picked up one by now for sure.
I mean, Bo Hosowa, I would put in the same category. Remember, he popped up at Olympic, what was that, back in 2012?
What about my boy Sam Ryder? You're not going to give him love? Come on, Sammy.
I think they're different caliber players, certainly coming out of college, and the expectations that Bo Hosowa or Patrick Rogers or Bud Cauley had were different. No offense to Sam Ryder. You mentioned Ben James, because I did want to get into him. He was the 36-hole leader, making his first start as a pro on the PGA Tour. I will say, and look, Ben James imploded. He shot 78 in the third round, ended up ultimately plummeting all the way outside the top 50, shot in the 60s again on Sunday to at least have somewhat of a respectable week in his PGA Tour debut as a pro. I think the thing that I love most about PGA Tour U, and you mentioned some of the misses as well, Gordon Sargent's game was already on the downturn when he was exiting college, which I think is a little bit different. Like, he did all of his work essentially the first 2 years Gordon Sargent was at Vanderbilt. He could have easily turned pro after his sophomore or junior year. Instead, he wanted to bide himself some time to turn around his game, and he hasn't quite recaptured what he'd done his first couple years at Vanderbilt, which is a little bit of a surprise. Jackson Koivun, I think, is that player we're all looking forward to seeing now. He's going to be playing next week's U.S. Open as an amateur, going to be making his PGA Tour pro debut in a couple weeks at the John Deere Classic. He's a player who I think the PGA Tour University Accelerator Program has done a good job of capturing right now. He's on the upswing. He has momentum. Now he can hit the ground running on the PGA Tour and sees what happens.
Ludvig, I would say Michael Thorbjørnsen. I mean, there's been more hits than misses when it comes to PGA Tour.
John Park, we're still waiting for.
Yes, but by and large, I would say it's been more hits than misses. Like, I am not knocking this program at all. If anything, I would criticize the PGA Tour for taking so long to create PGA Tour U, not what they've actually created. And thank you. I do want to clean that up. You're absolutely right. Ben James was leading through 36 holes, not 54 holes last week, and he did struggle on Saturday. And all of those things are fascinating to me, but the walking away or driving away from the Canadian Open, I was struck on Sunday afternoon, and we just don't get this enough. And I think this is what Brian Rolapp and his team talk about when you want to create layers of interest when it comes to fans. And today was one of those days. And I say that because Bud Cauley was a fascinating story, and anyone who knew his story at all, you were probably captivated by the idea that not only did he win, but he did it in a style that he could enjoy. It's one thing coming down the stretch and he was grinding away, but he had a two-stroke lead playing a par five for the last hole. That's one of those opportunities where you can make the most of it and truly enjoy that. But there were so many other storylines involved. When you look at what was up for grabs today, you had one player who has one more start left on his major medical and was grinding away trying to get it done. You had players who were vying for spots in the U.S. Open. Bud Cauley ended up taking that spot into the U.S. Open because he moved into the top 60 in the world rankings. You had players who were vying for spots in the Open Championship. Jackson Suber ended up doing both. Like, he joked with me when he came over to do the interview this afternoon, in 1 week, I qualified for both Opens. That's pretty cool. Like, he didn't win a PGA Tour event. But this is the layers of storytelling that I think that Brian Rolapp and his team talk about when you look at a Friday afternoon and they want to tell these stories about making a cut. And there's always stories there. It goes well beyond what did you shoot and where do you stand on the leaderboard. You and I both know, like, it goes much more deeper than that. And I think this was one of those days that's an example of that.
You know, I think that's a great shout out. I would also throw in the race for the Canadians as well, whether it was Sudarshan Yellamiraju, who ended up being a low Canadian. You also had a player by the name of Matthew Anderson. Rex, I've never heard of Matthew Anderson, and yet he was tied for the lead on Sunday at the RBC Canadian Open, trying to win his national open. It feels like that storyline, it went away quickly. I think he double bogeyed the 10th hole and was not heard from for the remainder of the round. But like, that storyline sort of went under the radar as well. But look, that's the benefit of the full field events. And after the US Open, the Travelers Championship, that's the last signature event that we have on the PGA Tour season. So when we get into the dog days of summer and we're getting in early to late July and August, like, these are sort of the stories. These are the layers to these full field events that we'll have plenty to chew on. One other quick point, Rex, I know your sausage finger's up. Mine was also up at the exact same moment. One other thing about Ben James, because I wanted to ask you about your interactions with him, because I was really interested in this, because this is a player who I thought was a pretty big story on that Friday, right? He's leading through 36 holes in what, again, was his first start as a pro on the PGA Tour. One of the, I think, hidden benefits of this PGA Tour University program is that Ben James is not just exempt on the PGA Tour full-time through the remainder of 2026. He has a PGA Tour card for a year and a half. That allows you, I think, the opportunity to learn, to get comfortable, to learn how to travel, to learn how to compete, to learn what sort of schedule and regimen and make friends and just sort of have a social life. Prior to PGA Tour University, and you'd have these great college stars coming out and trying to land on the PGA Tour, you're trying to mop up as many sponsor exemptions as you can get. Mm-hmm. And seven is the maximum for non-member sponsor exemption. So these guys would be playing all spring. They would have the NCAA championships, and then they would almost be playing every single week trying to earn as many points as possible to get a full PGA Tour card for the following season. I love the fact that this was not all or nothing for Ben James. And I think he even said as much, either to you or just in the flash area on Friday night, when people were like, Ben, you know, how do you think you're going to handle this environment, you know, leading a golf tournament, the PGA Tour, in your very first start? I don't know. I'm curious to find out. Never been in this position. It's going to be a lot of fun to figure out exactly what I can do in this position. Like, I loved that, as opposed to him having even more pressure to make sure that he converts on these opportunities because he's only going to have seven of them. That was just my final point on that.
Well, I kind of waded into your world, and I didn't mean to get too close on this one because I know college golf is your realm and you're the best at it. But I did. I reached out to his coach at the University of Virginia, Bowen Sargent, and because I wanted to get an idea of what makes – I wanted to tell his story, because I think this was the first week where people are starting to pay attention to him. And to your point, I was amazed first and foremost how relaxed he was coming into the week. I did an interview with him on Wednesday afternoon that ran later on Golf Central. And just the idea that Dr. Bob Rotella, the sports psychologist who he works with, and what did he tell you? And he goes, just go out and have fun. And when I spoke with his coach at Virginia, Coach Sargent, the idea was, is he runs hot on the golf course. Like, he expects a lot of himself. He's very intense. And this is important for him to show up this week and to make sure you enjoy this. Like, yes, of course, you want to go out and make the most of this opportunity, just like you want to do it for the next year and a half. But don't look back a year and a half from now and be like, I was miserable because I was putting so much pressure on myself. To your point, yes, I think that's the beauty of PGA Tour U. And there is a meritocracy to this. You could sit and say, well, no one should be guaranteed anything. He earned this via what he did in college. All of these players who came up through PGA Tour U earned it, just like any other player in almost any other sport, at least in the United States, would do. If you're a top-ranked quarterback coming out of college, yes, you're going to be given a guaranteed contract, and that allows you to develop as a player. It allows you to learn how to be a professional. It allows you to do your job to the best of your ability. That's one of the great parts about PGA Tour U. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, there's a reason why NFL franchises don't like starting rookie quarterbacks week one. Like they want them to ease into the season. They want to have a Kirk Cousins situation a Kirk Cousins, Fernando Mendoza situation in Vegas where you're learning from him. You're seeing how it worked for the first 6 or 7 weeks, and then all of a sudden you get in. If Jackson Koivun or a Ben James or a Miles Russell in a couple of years, whenever he makes the jump to the PGA Tour, is all outside. All right, man, you got 5, 6, 7 starts like it used to be. And if you don't succeed in those spot starts, again, feeling something that you've never felt before, all of a sudden you're going to be relegated to the Corn Ferry Tour. You're going to be going to PGA Tour Americas and traveling throughout Canada in a 2 or 3 month window. Like, this is just such a better runway provided for the next great players. And I think Ben James and whoever else comes along the line through PGA Tour University in the future is really going to benefit from them. Again, we're going to see Ben James next week. We're going to see Jackson Koivun next week as well, competing as an amateur at Shinnecock. One of the big stories on Sunday actually happened before the final round, and that was Brooks Koepka, who withdrew prior to the final round because of a hand issue. This actually popped up on Saturday. As you reported, he was receiving treatment before, during, and probably after his round as well. An issue, he said he was having, Rex, gripping the club with his left hand, his ring finger, and his pinky finger. Said he'd never had it before, but it got to the point he didn't want to give it a go on Sunday. You had an opportunity at least to talk to Brooks on Saturday. What's your level of concern? Because, of course, he is the defending champion of sorts at Shinnecock, having won the U.S. Open there in 2018.
I don't know that the level of concern is high right now, because, again, this is very, very new. This is something that he's never dealt with until Saturday morning at the Canadian Open. And it was a little shocking, actually, to see his trainer show up on the range. I was waiting to do a pre-round interview, and I wasn't really paying attention at all. And immediately you saw his trainer starting to work on what looked like his left elbow, something along those lines. You could probably make a jump and start trying to figure out, okay, golfer's elbow is very similar to this. Maybe he has an issue muscular. I will say he tried to warm up. It was cold. It was rainy. It was amazingly cold this week at the Canadian Open, by the way. I was pretty shocked by that. This might have been him just being safe, because, as you pointed out, next week is a huge week, not just because it's the U.S. Open, but because he is, you're right, the quasi-defending champion there, having won the last U.S. Open that was at Shinnecock Hills. Clearly, his focus is going to be on that. But it was strange when you watched him start that round on Saturday morning, and every single shot wasn't just a little right. It was way right, and you don't see that at a Brooks Koepka. Not the way he's playing right now. And the part, I guess, I got hung up with is through two rounds, it was his putting. And that's the one thing that we fixated on all season long, that if he could just putt decent, that you would expect big things out of Brooks. In this particular case, through two rounds, it was the ball striking that was kind of letting him down, at least statistically. His putting was solid. It felt like he had finally found at least something on the greens that would net him zero. We talk about this all the time when it comes to Scottie Scheffler, that as long as you have an average day on the greens, your ball striking is good enough that you should go out and you should be able to contend. That's what we saw out of Brooks through two rounds. So I guess that was the part that was surprising for me. And this came out of nowhere. Again, a withdrawal on a day that was cold. It was very rainy. The U.S. Open is coming up. I'm going to hold off concern until we know a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly doesn't sound good. The armchair doctors on social media will tell you, Rex, that if you're having issues in your ring finger and your pinky finger, that's a nerve issue. It could be your hand. It could be your elbow. It could be something that's going on in his back. It's all very confusing to me. I will say, your left hand, if you're a right-handed golfer, is incredibly important. That's your grip hand. That's your lead hand. And we're now heading to a golf course that we're going to talk about real quickly here. That's going to be very, very penal if you are missing. And all of a sudden you're hacking out a 5-6 inch rough with a hand that is a little bit banged up, would certainly be a little bit troublesome, but we're gonna have to wait for a official report. But it certainly at this point, we're recording this on Sunday evening, does seem like Brooks Koepka's status for the US Open could be in jeopardy.
I don't know that his status, I'm not willing to go down that road quite yet. I'm gonna do more reporting tomorrow on my way.
It's in jeopardy. I'm not saying it's in doubt. It's in jeopardy. It just means it's uncertain. It's uncertain.
But I will add to the conversation, as you and I, both golfers who have suffered through golfer's elbow, it seems very similar to what I think you and I both have dealt with, because it was right around the elbow. You're right. It's your lead hand. There's a lot going on there. So, yeah, of course, you're going to pay attention. But this came out of nowhere. And again, I made a point of asking, like, is this anything you've dealt with in the past before? And absolutely not. And I didn't even get the impression on Saturday night when I spoke with him about this that Sunday was in jeopardy. So you're right. It's something to keep an eye on.
Certainly unfortunate. I know a lot of people were backing Brooks. His odds looked good heading into the U.S. Open. His form, certainly from a ball striking standpoint, was very, very good. And had he found a fix with the putter, we've seen this a couple weeks ago at the Nelson where he putted well, at least for a couple rounds, and then again here in Canada, at least that part of the equation seemed to be on an upward trend. So we have to stay tuned for Brooks Koepka. Obviously, you can go to golfchannel.com. We'll be updating it there. As well. You and I have a very early start. You and I both have 4 a.m. wake-up calls. You and I both have 6 a.m. flights to head to the greater New York area for the Shinnecock U.S. Open. What are you most looking forward to? We're going to be recording the official preview podcast on Wednesday. What are you most looking forward to figuring out over these next couple of days?
I mean, you and I are going to race to our house, which is in Southampton, so thank you very much for that. So we won't be commuting back and forth between, I guess, LaGuardia Airport is where we end up staying. The golf course. I want to see the golf course as soon as possible because there was a lot of conversation. I had a conversation with Matt Fitzpatrick tonight about it. He played in 2018. He was there a few weeks ago and he was sort of walking me through the idea that normally at a U.S. Open, you really want to fixate on making sure you hit fairways, whatever that takes. I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case at Shinnecock. They've widened some fairways. They were already pretty wide. It's going to be all about the green complex. It's kind of similar to the conversation probably we had at the PGA Championship, maybe times two, times three, something along those lines, because we know those greens can, the elevated greens with the way the wind can come off the sound, they're so exposed. We had a meeting last week. Both of us were on a Zoom call with the USGA. I think there is a concern that they want to make sure that this year doesn't get away from them. Because it seems as if that's been sort of the nature of this golf course the last few U.S. Opens. So I would guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, but my takeaway from that meeting that we had with the USGA is they're going to err on the side of caution.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. In fact, I have my notes from that meeting.
Ooh, so many notes.
Right here. I'm with you. I think the golf course is going to be fascinating. And one of the mantras that the USGA, you're going to hear touted over and over again in the run-up to this championship, is just let Shinnecock be Shinnecock. And what happened in 2004, what happened to a lesser degree, at least for the majority of the week back in 2018, was they just didn't live up to their ideals. And their philosophy in those two US Opens was, we wanted to create a US Open experience for the entirety of the week. That means when players arrived on Monday and Tuesday for championship week, it was already going to be really, really firm and really, really difficult. And the mantra of the USGA and the philosophy has changed slightly over the past couple of years, where they sort of want to ease into the championship. And by the time the weekend arrives and you win a down the cut and you are identifying the contenders, you really have the golf course where you want it, where you really have to have exact precision, and errant shots are really going to be penalized in a significant way. I think it's going to be very interesting. You mentioned the width of the fairways. I'm diving into these notes a little bit. An average of 48 yards wide. Typically the U.S. Open venues that we've had there have been about 30 yards. Again, this is not them widening the fairways at Shinnecock. This is how Shinnecock plays for the members. What they'd done in previous U.S. Opens was narrow the fairways, going against what the architect had originally intended. So yes, it's going to be pretty wide corridors. Those are going to be shrinking when you do have the forecasted winds between 20 and 30 miles an hour for the majority of the tournament days as well. It's going to be a second shot golf course. And with the winds as forecasted, it's going to be a scrambling contest as well. I think it's going to be spectacular. You could make an argument this is the best championship test that the USGA has to offer for the US Open. I think it's going to be spectacular and cannot wait to get to Southampton, not least of which because we are staying in a mansion just a couple of miles from the golf course. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Chill Podcast with Rex and Lav. As a reminder, Rex and I will be on live from the U.S. Open Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday in the run-up to the championship. We will also have a preview podcast on Wednesday that will be going up on YouTube. We will also, Rex, have another edition of the Live From newsletter with Rex and Lav that will be working on in the run-up to the championship and then hit your inboxes on Thursday, hopefully not in your spams, but do go check it there as well. So plenty of offering on this front over the next couple of days. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. We'll talk to you guys on Wednesday for the next edition of the pod. But look out for us on live.